Good morning. This is At Issue on WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA, Catskill Hudson. I'm Victor Mandolia.
I'm Debbie Mayer.
And
Supervisor William Hughes.
Hi, William.
Try that again.
And Supervisor William Hughes
is our guest this morning.
Yeah, we're with Supervisor William Hughes Jr., who is the 4th Ward Supervisor from the City of Hudson on the Columbia County Board of Supervisors, and also has just been reelected Minority Leader of the Board of Supervisors. So congratulations on that.
Yes.
Thank you. Happy New Year to everyone.
Thank you.
We're going to be speaking with Supervisor Hughes in a few minutes, but we are going to start with Debbie. My co-host has prepared some material about people we lost in 2015.
Yes, thank you. I have a few names here of people that we lost that I'd just like to remember. I'm having a little bit of technical difficulties here, folks, so I'm going to do the best I can. So the year 2015 began on January 1st with the death of Mario Cuomo, who had been governor of New York for many years.
Three terms.
Yeah, see, I don't have some of these details, Victor, so I need you to remember. I think of him as the good Cuomo. he died in advanced age. The year kind of ended with the death of Ellsworth Kelly, the internationally known distinguished artist who lived in Spencertown in Columbia County. He died on December 27th at the age of 92. He had lived in Spencertown since the early 70s for at least 45 years. And in addition to being a distinguished artist, he was also very generous with donations to Columbia County schools and arts organizations. He was a terrific guy. Now, less well known, perhaps, are some of these other people that I would like to mention. One is Walter W. Beveridge III, who died on October 10th in 2015 at the age of 75. He was someone that I met through Toastmasters, where he was a very vital presence in Toastmasters. And I learned through reading his obituary that his profession was working for IBM. And then he had lots of things that he liked to do. And he was a commercial balloon pilot with his own business under that name, Float on Air. So Walter could not only speak well, he could float on air. And in Columbia County, we lost a couple of longtime farmers. Anthony Tony Ooms was 81 when he died on September 9th of 2015, and that's the Ooms Farm up in the north of Columbia County. In addition, by reading Mr. Ooms's obituary, I learned that he served on the Chatham Planning Board for more than 40 years. I'd like you to think about that, please, for a moment, listeners. This man was 81 when he died, God bless him, and he had served half his life on the Chatham Planning Board. Personally, I can't imagine such a thing, but good for him. And he was involved in dairy organizations and liked to bowl. That's one of our farmers. And then
the Ooms family also put a substantial portion of their property in the CLC.
There you go.
Conservancy.
Yes.
Well.
Thank you, Victor.
Conserving it as farmland forever.
Yes. All right. And then I wanted to take note of Frank O. Kotzel of the Kotzel's Restaurant, who tried to do something else and then went into the family business. He went to college and then he went to work for the family business, which was called at that time the Old Post Tavern and now is Kotzel's. He was 87 when he died. Right. And then we have another elderly farmer, Robert Frederick Fix, who died at 81. He was a Livingston farm. He was a third-generation co-owner with his brother, Bill, on Fix Brothers Fruit Farm, which is just south of Hudson. His obituary noted that he enjoyed his bulldozer, making ponds, and clearing land to prepare for another orchard of delicious fruit. I'd like to just note quickly Cynthia Owen Phillip, who was actually a resident of Rhinecliff, south of here. She was 87 when she died. And she was a writer and historian locally. The Hudson Valley was her passion, and public service and community. And she lived in the Hudson Valley almost all her 87 years. Now, then, Esther Faiety Tuttle of Kinderhook died on July 9th at the age of 104. She was an actress on Broadway, an author, and had the nickname of the best granny ever. Born in 1911, her acting career began in New York City in the 1930s as she appeared on Broadway with Humphrey Bogart, Leslie Howard, and in summer stock with Henry Fonda. And then she was featured, it says here, in the New York Times as a centenarian. And she was also featured in a BBC documentary on how to live a long, active life. As a granny model, something I could maybe aspire to, she enjoyed appearing in commercials, print ads, and magazines like Rolling Stone, Shape, and Vogue. She appeared on Law and Order, The Conan O'Brien Show, and The David Letterman Show. And in movies, in case you can remember her, including Cher's Moonstruck and Julia Roberts' film Mona Lisa. She was a dedicated volunteer. I mean, when you're 104, your obit goes on pretty far. So that's, okay, now I've got to switch modes here. Victor,
okay.
You can say something quickly if you wish. Oh, no, it's...
Of course, we you know, we're not aiming to hit every single person in
no.
the county that we lost. These
no.
are just some of the people that have come to Debbie's attention.
Yeah,
and
right.
have stood out for one particular reason
right.
or another.
As I raced through a year's worth of obituaries last night. But here in Hudson, we also remember Christina Malisoff, who died on April 19th at the young age of 56.
Someone very special and
yes.
dear here at the station, of course.
Yes, absolutely. Longtime resident of Germantown in Hudson. She was an artist, a nurse, a gardener, a community organizer, an activist, and for 9 years also served on the programming staff at the Hudson Opera House. So she did all kinds of things. And I went to, we had a wonderful memorial service for her at the Hudson Opera House. I almost didn't go because I didn't know Christina all that well. And then I thought, no, I'll go. And it was, in addition to the Pride Parade, Victor and Bill, this was the best community event in Hudson that I have ever been to. People just forgot themselves and focused on Christina.
Wonderful.
It was great. Did you go, Victor?
I wasn't there. I wasn't in town.
Yeah.
Right.
It was great. So, yes, let's end with that's what I have today for you folks.
And particularly with Christina, I think it was a long time illness that
yes.
she had been suffering from, but certainly is one of the people that are so dearly missed here,
yes.
Both at the station and the city of Hudson, and mm-hmm. we miss her very terribly. Hard act to follow.
Yeah, there you go, Christina to Bill.
I'm thinking that like we lost some really some really great people in the community, and they're big shoes to fill. So hopefully, going forward, we have people to step into those shoes. And one of the other things I noticed is you listen to the age of the farmers, it told you a little bit about. Their hard work and all that led to them having actually a long life.
Into their 80s, right.
Yeah, which tends not to happen for a lot of us who just sit around and watch football.
So a lot's going on. We have a new mayor here in the city of Hudson,
yes.
A new chairman of the Board of Supervisors. We have a new supervisor, Doreen Davis, who was a big winner in Catskill. Of course, both the Catskill race and the Hudson race were very close.
Mm-hmm.
Both came down to absentee ballots, which things often do here. The departure of Chairman Grattan, Pat Grattan, the supervisor from Kinderhook, and now Matt Morrell, who has taken his place. And I will stop for a second. We had hoped to have Supervisor Morrell on today, and it was listed on our on the program guide for the station. But we will have Chairman Morrell on an upcoming show, but he wasn't able to make it today. So tell us a little bit about the changes, the changing of the guard, both on the city level, but particularly on the Board of Supervisors level, and what changes do you think for the good or bad, or how do you see things going?
I'll start, with the city, and obviously that'll be a little, I'll know a little less about that. It's the first woman, so I think a lot of people are excited about that. I do know, attending a couple of state meetings, that was brought up, is that some of the other women mayors throughout the state, like Minor and up in Saratoga, mm-hmm. With Jepson and a few of the others, are looking to meet up with Mayor Hamilton and talk about some issues that they face, not only in their cities, but as women. Mm-hmm. So I think that will come about. I always had this philosophy.
That's interesting that mayors of relatively large cities have Hudson on the map. It's pretty
yeah.
great.
Well, Hudson is small but mighty, and we're starting to make a real name for ourselves throughout the state. And for people who don't know, I travel quite a bit now, and I'm going through the state. And there's not many places I go where Hudson isn't known anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the train all the time, and I hear them people talking about it. And a lot of times I'll interject myself into their conversations, and they're like, oh, you're from Hudson. And they will know quite a bit about Hudson from reading in the New York Times or the various,
travel magazines,
independent magazines and things that are coming out. So, yeah, Hudson is small, but I would argue that we probably get as much publicity as some of the bigger cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for a little city, size we are, we certainly get a lot of press.
Yeah, so, I have to echo Bill that wherever I go, if I tell people I'm from Hudson, they say, oh, Hudson.
Oh,
yeah.
I know
lucky
Hudson.
You.
I hear
yeah,
about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I see that Mayor Hamilton, she's off and running, and I text her to let her know that I thought she did a great job with her appointments. Obviously, I didn't agree with all of them, but mm-hmm. you don't get everything you want.
Who
but
does?
Overall scope of what she did initially coming in, I think she did a great job as far as her appointments.
I think so too.
Moving forward, there's a lot of work to be done in the city of Hudson. I think there's some bridges to be mended between, with the council and the executive branch and all the facets of the city. And we'll see how she goes through and handle that. That will be important for her and important for the residents of the city of Hudson. I think there's a great opportunity there. She just takes advantage of it and things will be fine in the city, I think.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the county... Looking at the county, I had a great working relationship with Pat. I really did. He had an open door policy. He had a lending ear. We didn't always agree. And most times people didn't see that in the public. We would have, Pat and I would have some spirited debates and disagreements behind closed doors. And when we came out to the floor, he would know that I was going to disagree with a subject, and he would allow me to voice my opinion, and he would voice his. We did it in a respectful tone, but we also, let people in our party know that, we were still sticking to the party principles of what we believed on that particular topic. I'm hoping to have that same kind of spirit with Matt, and I'm pretty sure I will. And for most people who don't know, You know, I know people really associate my being in politics with the Grandinettis, and I'm very close to the Grandinetti family, and they are really responsible for getting me employment in the county, which I, you know, changed my life. You know, and I will always say that they, you know, it was Mr. Grandinetti and Miss Grandinetti who changed my life, you know, financially and in a lot of aspects. But it was Matt that really got me into politics, and I really didn't want any part of it.
Matt Morrell?
Matt Morrell.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was down in the hallway one day, and he had two openings on the County Youth Advisory Board, and he said, hey, you know, what do you think about joining my advisory board? And I said, absolutely not. And he was like, well, you know, we get state money, and our board decides where that state money goes. And I said, still not interested. He goes, well, it could affect the Boys Club, Operation Unite, you know, some of the other centers downtown the city of Hudson. You might want to think about it. I said, okay, I'll think about it. And then I took him up on the offer, and you know, I was on the committee. Mm-hmm. He left to go to a higher office in OCFS. Jessica Nabazi came in. I assumed chairmanship of that committee.
Just for our listeners, that OCFS is what?
Office of Children and Family Services.
Right.
You know, I became chairman of that committee. And then soon after, people were, you know, hey, you need to get into politics. And you need to, you know, so, and that was my first real foray, because it gave me a real understanding of what resolutions were. People have to, you know, if you were never introduced to politics at that level, it's intimidating. Mm-hmm. To get there, because you really just don't know something as simple as A and A. Okay, it means yes and no, but what are you voting on? What is a resolution, or how does it get introduced, or, you know, how do you divide up funding, and where does funding come from? I learned all that through the Youth Bureau.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
I think one of the most interesting stories about you, and this is, you know, I mean, I know this from our friendship, but You were a custodian at 401 State Street, and
yes.
Often I think the people who were in the office were not necessarily like, they were like, oh, that's just Bill, he's the custodian, but mm-hmm. really you were learning and understanding and hearing much of what was going on at mm-hmm. 401 State Street. And for those who don't know, 401 State Street is basically the center of county government, and later obviously became first an alderman and then a supervisor.
Yep.
What are your thoughts about that?
It actually was a little more in depth than that. I actually developed a really good relationship with Jerry Simons. The late, great Jerry Simons, and also Gladys Gush. And if anyone knows Gladys, she was the clerk of the board.
And Jerry Simons was the chair of the board.
Was the chairman.
The supervisor from Ankrum, yes.
Gladys ran the county. Mm-hmm. When Jerry wasn't sitting in that seat, it was Gladys you answered to. Although she was the clerk of the board, she wielded a lot of power, even statewide.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jerry would invite me in there every morning for coffee, and he'd sit down and he would say, Bill, and he was the first one that really asked me my opinion. He goes, tell me, what's going on downtown? You know, I think an important...
And when was this approximately, would you say? In the 90s?
This had to be probably 2000, uh-huh. maybe 2001. It was before I was elected alderman. I got elected alderman in 2003. And he was really the first person to ask my opinion about anything, you know, outside of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, I would sit down and talk to him about the black community, the black churches, how, you know, things operate very differently within the black community. We use our churches not only for, you know, prayer and, you know, worship, but also to disseminate information, food drives, clothing drives. I mean, the black church
even
is...
Even politics as well.
In politics yeah. as well. The black church is... the black community,
mm-hmm.
and it's still that today.
For most, I mean, for some. I mean, clearly some people are not interested.
Right. I mean, it's starting to get away from that a little bit.
Yeah,
but
there are
it's
other
still,
organizations.
There's still solid roots. And if you were to go towards the city, even more so. Up north, it's starting to wean a little bit. But those are the things that he always asked me about. And so I think I learned a lot from them, but I think they learned a lot from me as well.
Mm-hmm. Just for context, do you remember when Jerry Simons died? How long ago we're talking about?
I don't remember the year, but I definitely remember the day and the time. You know, I remember when he even got really sick. You know, and it was just a sad time because towards the end, he and I had difference of opinion, but I had a great deal of respect for Jerry and his family. You know, they for the people he liked. He really liked, and he gave you his whole heart.
I came to Hudson in 2006, and I believe he was already passed by then.
Yeah, I think so. I have a little story about Jerry Simons, who was the Republican supervisor of Ankrum for, what, decades?
Forever.
right. And so he used to preside over the town board meetings, and there was a sign in back of him that said, no smoking. And Jerry would sit there with a butt between his fingers.
That sign did not apply to Jerry Simon, nor Gladys.
Wow, that's hysterical. So you had a very good working relationship with Pat Gratton, as did the Democrats.
Yes.
I think one of the big changes when Gratton took over was that the Democrats were asked which committees they'd like to sit on and then were given those committees.
That's
That was a big change from previous board chairman.
Well, I think Chairman Baer actually was the first to implement that. But what Chairman Baer did is he surrounded himself with people who were going to, be loyal to his ideas. And he... he was going to allow Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and Conservatives to serve around him, but you necessarily weren't going to, at least from my opinion, I don't want to, disparage him in any way, but I just didn't feel as though you could have your own opinion about an issue and have an open ear listening to it.
It was really about being in line.
Right. Whereas with Pat, he truly gave you an open ear and he truly listened to your opinions. Now he may take that opinion and put some of his own spin on it, but at the end of the day, it was a collaboration. Whereas an idea would come about, and you would have a shared idea and it would go forward. A prime example is the Labor Management Committee. Rick Scalera and I were the ones that came up with that, and it was something that Rick told me about that was being applied at Hudson Correctional. And so we adapted it to be applied on the county level. I went to Pat. Pat said, okay, well, let me think about it. He sat down and he thought about some nuances and he says, okay, we'll put it together. It'll be a bipartisan committee. You and Rick Scalera, and I'll pick two people on the Republican side. And since that time, at one point in time, we were spending between $300,000 to $400,000 a year in just fighting county grievances. After implementing that committee, we probably spent a total of over the last two to three years, maybe $10,000.
And what is that a result of? How does that happen?
Well, because a lot of times grievances, and people don't understand, grievances at the labor level are nitpicking things. And before we had the Labor Management Committee in place, we were leaving the decision.
I mean, I suppose they're not always nitpicking.
Right, but we were leaving decision making up to whether we would fight a grievance and how we would fight a grievance to the department head. And then if a department head didn't like a particular person or they were really passionate about an issue, instead of taking themselves out and just thinking about the issue, it became personal. And so they would fight that grievance and often lose the fight, and it would cost not only the county the cost of fighting the grievance, but the end result. Whereas when it comes to labor management, we try to take personality out of it. It's just about the issue, just about what's in front of us.
So if a grievance is brought now, it's handled by the labor management?
A grievance is filed by a department head. It will come to the union. The union will notify human resources, and they will bring it to labor management. And we, at that time, will decide on the merits of that, that grievance coming from the department head. And
the old method was what?
The department head would decide.
That's
the department
a disaster.
Head would go to the chairman, and the department head would decide on along with labor council.
No wonder it costs so much. Yeah,
right.
Because it becomes a grudge match.
Right.
Wow.
And again, that but that that committee in itself really does save us a lot of money. And, and this year, we really got into some really big issues, which I can't disclose. But it is saved, you know. And I think that was great foresight on Pat's part. And one of the things that he did, he had us pass a resolution on the county level, because truthfully, the labor management was only a recommendation committee. But he had us pass a resolution on the county level, giving, you know, the authority to the chairman to resolve any policy issues without going back to the board. And he in turn gave that authority to all of us on the labor management. So we make policy decisions right then and there.
And who sits on that committee now?
So the new committee, I believe, is going to be Supervisor Scalera and myself, Mike Benvenuto, and replacing Matt Morrell will be Ed Nabosny. At least that's what I saw from the...
I have the chart also.
The new release.
So in the as we've mentioned in the past, you were the Democrats have been given the committees that they asked for. Did that happen again this year under Matt Morrell?
Actually, probably a little more. I have a couple of deputy chairmanships, you know, of committees. Sarah has a deputy. Rick Scalera is deputy on a couple of committees. No chairmanships, but I think you see now where the committees have much more balance, you know, and you have many more deputy chairs who are Democrats than I think since you know, Art Bear was there.
Interesting. Yeah, I see that you are deputy of Human Services Committee,
which I'm very passionate about.
Yeah, good. And deputy of the Point One Committee, which is... one of those arcane things.
Yeah,
Point one is salary?
Point one is salary or anything that would normally come before point one. You know, expenditures and things of that nature.
Well, you know, just as an aside, calling it the Point One Committee is not necessarily very transparent to the public. The public does not understand what that is. Just something to think about.
Well, so how the Point One Committee actually came about is Art Bear... we used to have a committee where we used to bring all point one and all point four vouchers before, and you had two people, one from each party, who would meet every Monday of the month, you know, every first Monday of the month, and they would go in and go through the vouchers. And I could tell you, because I was one of those two people when Doug McGivney couldn't do it. And we two people would go in and make the financial decision on whether those vouchers should be signed.
It's a very bizarre system.
Right. So Art Bear came in and said, you know what? I'm going to create this subcommittee, point one, and, you know, panel five or six people to review all these to decide whether they should go on to finance or not instead of just going straight to full board. And so that's how it first came about. Right. And then, obviously, Pat elaborated on it, and Matt actually has now, this is the first time that it has been a standing committee. Previously, it was a subcommittee.
Right.
Right. Pat Gratton's the chair, and you're the deputy.
I mean, I'm just saying that, like, maybe if it were called the Financial Approval Committee
I totally get what you're saying.
For the public, they might, I mean, no one understands what point one or point four is.
Right, because most people don't know that point one is speaking more towards salaries and things that are of financial nature versus the point fours, which is, you know, stuff that we have to spend.
Expenses,
and
right.
We don't require a board approval for.
So there were also a number of I mean, the Democrats picked up seats this time. And so do you feel like the caucus is stronger? I know that some of the people who were elected as Democrats are not necessarily sitting with the Democrats in the caucus, but
All the Democrats are actually sitting with the Democrats.
Well, except Lowell, right?
Well, Lowell's actually she's a registered Republican.
Right, yeah. But I mean, who were elected on the Democratic
ticket. Okay, elected on the Democratic ticket. Well, yeah, so you had who used to caucus with the Democrats was Supervisor Lagonia, who is now going to caucus with the Republicans. And to his credit, he actually had a face-to-face conversation with me about that. And he was torn between it. And I knew that... there was more to the situation, which I won't get into, but there was more to the situation. But we did talk about it personally, and I told him that I would not disapprove of him going over to the Republican caucus, if that is, you know, what his wish was. I believe that him doing that, he would be given more opportunity. And I believe that he had more to offer to the community and he wasn't given an opportunity solely because he was caucusing with us. So it was probably going to be to his benefit and also the county's benefit to have him caucus with the Republicans. So I didn't disapprove of that. With Mrs. Law, I really didn't know her. With Supervisor Law, I didn't know of her. But I was looking forward to having her caucus with the Democrats. Unfortunately, that, you know, that didn't transpire. And you know, I certainly wish her the best of luck over there. And again, as I see it, more and more, though, regardless of what caucus you're in, supervisors now develop an independent opinion and kind of vote on their either their town wishes or their independent conscience. Mm-hmm. So the party influence of how you vote, it rears its head, but very rarely. I can't say it doesn't at all, but it's rare.
Right. I mean, it seems to often be most apparent on like appointments, like the county attorney and things like that.
That's when it's apparent.
Right.
You know, and it showed up when you had the gun issue. And there was a couple of things that, you know, a real hard line party issues where it showed up. But, you know, for the general things that affect us on a day-to-day basis, I don't see, you know, where it's reflected in the vote.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and so back to that. I do want to point out that Ray Statz has rejoined our caucus, which I'm pleased about. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously there was some differences of opinion between Ray and myself, along with the previous chairman of the County Democratic Party, Cindy Hall. So I think he chose to sit out the caucus for the last 2 years, but he came back in and we welcome him with open arms. And I always had a great deal of respect for Ray because he is very knowledgeable. He's very passionate about finances and open transparency. You know, he and I do things a little differently, but I think he's a great asset, and I think he certainly will bring a positive voice to our caucus.
Mm-hmm. He had been the minority leader, and you took mm-hmm. the minority leader seat, so I think that was some obvious.
Yeah,
some...
I think, mm-hmm. you know, just how that all came about, whereas I felt I should have been the year that he became, and, you know, so that was the internal politics of it. You know, hopefully, you know,
well, that's encouraging.
Yeah, hopefully those mm-hmm. those feelings mm-hmm. are obviously we'll still feel each other out, and
right.
but just having him, you know, come and sit in the caucus with us and now declare that he will be caucusing with us is a real positive, I think.
And of course, Edna Bosny had been previously supervisor in Greenport,
yeah.
lost the seat by a very close race. Mm-hmm. Is it 4 years ago? I guess they have 4 year terms.
It's
right?
2 year term.
Oh, 2 year term. So two yeah. years ago, and then ran again this time, and then unsat John Parrica, who mm-hmm. had been who had previously beat him, yeah. And he's an Independence Party member, mm-hmm. but is caucusing with the Democrats as well. Right?
That's correct. And Ed too is someone I enjoyed working with Ed the last time that he was supervisor. So, you know, I'm looking forward to working with him. And again, I think Hudson and Greenport should rethink the conversations about emerging other governments. I know there's a lot of people that you know, are like, oh, my God, we don't want any part of Hudson. But you have to look at the financial.
Well, it goes the other way, too.
Yeah, but. It does. I don't want any part of Greenport.
Well, but the financial, for me, the financial benefits may far outweigh uh-huh. and far outstrip any kind of political self, you know, self-preservation that we may have.
Mm-hmm. And for our listeners who don't really understand that, one of the things that cities can do that towns can't do is preempt their sales tax, which means that they take their sales tax portion directly.
That's generated within
their municipality.
Right. Uh-huh.
And because Greenport has such a high number of commercial businesses.
Right.
It's a huge center of sales tax income, but they're not allowed to preempt it themselves. So
right.
for them, they would be able to keep their sales tax.
And I would argue that Hudson, with our restaurants and our tourism, we're
certainly on par.
We
don't know the exact numbers because, unfortunately, we share a zip code, and it's very difficult to mm-hmm. extrapolate those numbers. Mm-hmm. But it would seem that if there was a merging of the government and we preempted the sales tax in the larger municipality, that it would be a huge tax decrease for both Greenport and for Hudson.
Uh-huh.
Some of the people don't understand, you know, may not understand why Hudson and Greenport. Sometimes we have this conversation, but it's not just about the sales tax. Think about. When you have a fire at one end of the Greenport, depending on where that fire is, you may have to cross through the city of Hudson to get to the other end of Greenport.
Oh, they come by my house all
the same
time.
The same thing with plowing roads.
Right. Traditionally, Greenport was part of Hudson.
So when you look at, you know, the savings that you could possibly have through your fire companies, that you could possibly mm-hmm. have through your DPW departments or your trash pickup, and then you factor in the fact of, you know, this money that you would get from sales tax, the lowering of the budget and the additional, you know, tax revenue, you could substantially reduce the tax rate in which we pay within our mm-hmm. borders.
Right.
We could be down there where Kinderhook or some of these other towns are paying mm-hmm. and make have far less stress on homeowners.
Not to mention that there are state initiatives there are grants available for merging of governments and creating less government,
shared services. Also, that came up in Germantown the other night.
So we've burned through a lot of time, and we haven't really even talked about much about policy. So, where do you see the top priorities for county government this time?
So, coming in, I think the number one top. Well, I can't say number one, but I think in the top five, let me put it that way. The top five is going to be infrastructure. We're going to have to look at our roads and bridges and our buildings and take a real hard look. We have buildings that are in deplorable condition. We have roads and bridges that...
You mean municipal buildings?
Municipal buildings.
Yeah, county-owned.
County-owned buildings. We have roads and bridges that are red flagged, that we actually had to close a couple of bridges. We're going to have to do some work on... I mean, we're just not prioritizing it, or we haven't prioritized mm-hmm. them correctly in the past, and we're reevaluating that now, but... You're looking, anytime you do a road or bridge or looking at buildings, you're looking at tens of millions of dollars.
Right.
And with a 2% tax cap in place, it doesn't have forgiveness for you to do capital projects like that. So
I want to come back to bridges, but give us your top five first.
Okay. So looking at infrastructure, we're looking at transparency. We're going to have a conversation around, having the public have more participation and things of that nature. And I think Matt is really open to that. So, kudos to him. And I'm looking forward to sitting down with him and talking about those kinds of things. We're going to have another thing is government collaborations between the county, the towns, the city and the county. I think there's some real opportunities coming up as far as sharing services on a highway and plowing of roads and storage of salt, maybe even some collaborations on building and locations mm-hmm. between the city of Hudson and the county. So, that too is could be paramount. Transportation. We're going to take a harder look, and Supervisor Sterling is working along with, a few of the Republicans and also Ken Flood to take a deeper look at our transportation system and going to the college and how we can get that done. So I think that's going to be pretty high. Along with, I'm also encouraging the county for us to look at the MTA rail system and also a platform down at the train station, because Amtrak is becoming very expensive. And you're looking at the tourism in Columbia County, mm-hmm. You could arguably say that Hudson has become a prime gateway into Columbia County.
Right.
And the rail, just going by the fact that Hudson is always in the top now four or five busiest on that Northeast corridor. If you had where the prices are now, it is it's really strangle. I think it's strangling it
right.
for a certain, you know, certain population. If you had MTA prices here, with more frequent, you know, train routes and a direct route to Grand Central, I think you would see an explosion of tourism in this area.
Right.
It's just the fact of getting it done.
You know, the Wassaic Station, of course, is an MTA station. And,
yep.
And for the people in the eastern, southeastern part of the county, they always use Wassaic because of it, because of the cost.
Because of the cost.
And they run more often. It's
right.
It's like, can be a third or a quarter even of the price, depending on what time, you know, and how high the prices go on Amtrak.
Yep. And so the last thing of importance, and I think we're going to take a look at, is the county manager. We're going to revisit that issue of county manager, county executive. That may not be in the immediate, so that may be sometime in the middle of this year. But, you know, I have had encouraging talks with Pat. And I'm sure that Matt isn't, you know, far behind on that for us to revisit that issue. If nothing else, look at the old data, bring together some form of a committee.
And the further it gets into the term, the less likely it is to happen, I
well,
think. But
I think I'm encouraged by the conversations that we had that we will enter into looking into that.
Mm-hmm. Great. So on infrastructure, I mean, one of the most pressing things for Mayor Hamilton in Hudson is the closure of the Ferry Street Bridge. It's something that Mayor Hallenbeck was unable to really get anything moving on other than shutting it down. And it seemed, from what I understand, that bridge had not even really been on the county list of potential bridges.
Still isn't.
And it's still not. No. So... A, why is that? Why is that? Why is a bridge
because
that is the gateway to the county seat, you know, the biggest park in the county seat? Why is it not a part of the planning of county level?
Because the city never declared that bridge as being city owned to the county. There was always a dispute of who owned that bridge and who actually had the rights to it, and thus. Given the city themselves never knew who clearly owned that bridge, we could not.
I mean,
now,
but it's been known for some time now.
Well, it still hasn't been declared. I mean, I haven't even seen the city actually come out only like say 6 or 7 months ago and say that we own it. Well, now come to the county and say we own this bridge and we need to have it fixed and it's the gateway. That's all great, and I live in the city of Hudson, so I would argue to put it at the top of the list. But I could tell you, we probably have 5 bridges in the city. I mean, in the county. That are in just as bad a condition. So how do I now leapfrog those other 4 or 5?
Right, but are they closed?
One is in danger of being closed, and one of the bridges that's between Raystown, we just totally ignored and we deprioritized it and put it at the, you know, behind some other bridges. So, you know, these fights have already been going on between supervisors of other towns. So now to interject myself in there and say Hudson is more important would be a tough fight. But I could tell you what I did do early on in knowing this, and some may not know this or some may know it, but that boat launch is the county's launch point for any river emergency. And so I articulated that to the state. I asked for written letters from our EMC, which is Emergency Management Services Coordinator, PJ, from the sheriff, from the fire coordinator, to indicate the importance of having that, you know, that crossway open and having access, you know, to that launch point without going across the railroad tracks in case the train is coming or
well, even if it's clear, it's still almost like another 2 minutes to go down and back around.
So. The importance of that bridge, yes, is economics, for, you know, opening up our waterfront and having public access.
Right.
But I think the onus really needs to be put on the fact that that is the primary launch point for.
It's
any
also
kind
a
of,
state a state boat
with,
launch.
Right.
I mean,
along
it's
with
not
the state docks.
It isn't
there.
It isn't just that. It's emergency services. There's always this state. Basically, it's part of the state park system. I would assume it would be. what it is, right?
So I just see where the governor has is going to be putting in his state of state. And I know he already has projects outlined, but usually they set some discretionary funds aside. As far as looking at state infrastructure, and he's looking to do $6 or $7 billion, I believe that the number is.
Yeah, he just announced a whole bunch of money.
And so I have these letters in hand, and I fully intend on, you know, speaking with the governor's office and the mayor, you know, the mayor and also the county. I think it needs to be, you know, a three-pronged attack and go up there with hat in hand and say, look, we really need to have this bridge open, and not today. We really needed it open yesterday. So I think it's imperative that we had those conversations. Hopefully they would oblige us, and I think we could get it done. I forgot what the number was, but I last I heard it was a couple $1 million. So, you know, I think that would be a really worthy project for the state to come down and get that, help us get that bridge rebuilt.
You know, even if it was part of the regional economic development money or whatever. I mean,
I don't care what pot it comes from, to be
right.
honest.
I mean, but it clearly it shouldn't only be a county problem. It clearly shouldn't only be a city problem. It really, there's multiple levels of government that really should be working to make this thing happen.
Well, how I see it now, the way the look that Governor Cuomo has been taking as far as looking at waterfronts and the development of waterfront property along the coastline of the Northeast. He's been investing a great deal of money into upstate New York. And he's to get kudos for that, but to upstate New York. And he's been focusing on waterfronts. Now, with that being said, our waterfront through his administration hasn't really benefited to that.
Partially.
To the point.
I mean, right. we can't get our LWMP.
Right. So I think though, if he, you know, he or his administration was to see what our waterfront, the potential that we have here, and granted, we would have to put together a viable plan to be shovel ready. I think we need to work towards that. But one of the primary things is first having that bridge open and having people, developers come there and see what the potentials are. But right now, as a developer, I'm not even coming to look if I see that you have the main access to the waterfront closed.
Right, right.
So.
Yeah, well, he's announcing $7 billion in proposals
for
upstate. Yeah, of course, that's a big
I would say a great deal of that money is already targeted. But when you have a budget like that, there's always a small pot of discretionary funds are probably, you say $7 billion, they probably have $8 to $10 million of discretionary funds set aside.
Right, and $100 million for water infrastructure investments.
Which is either sewage or
bridges
or drinking water, I guess, right? I don't think it's really bridges.
I'm not sure the specifics until he actually do the state of the state, but you can be sure I will be going up to the state with those letters in hand and really begging.
So you mentioned transportation and potential bus service out to the college. Do you think that's actually something that we can get done? It seems like one of the disappointments I think in the city is Hudson. We gave up our localized transportation service, the bus service, the former fake trolleys that we used to have, and merged with the Columbia County bus service, which isn't much to speak of either. But there, it seems like in amount of service that probably was a bad thing to relinquish. Do you see, you know, one of the biggest problems in this county is getting transportation to work.
Right.
We have Flanders over here, which employs a large number of people, but people, there's no way to get there without a car.
A lot of people walk.
Yeah. And a lot of people
walk. Walking by.
But
are they ride bikes?
Is there a way for a county like ours, which is very rural, to improve its bus service cost effectively. I mean, I guess.
So, and I'm glad you say cost effectively, because that was the exact problem with the Hudson Trolley. The Hudson Trolley was being state subsidized, and the city of Hudson had to kick in a great deal of money. And I know, because I was one of the ones that voted towards us eliminating that. It just was way, it was costing the city way more than we right. were. We weren't getting the bang for even the quarter. I mean, right. we just weren't getting our money's worth. But with that being said, the county system that we have, the county system that we have now, too, is not, I don't believe, adequate for what we need as far as having a real true link between the shopping centers and the employers who actually are hiring a great deal of people without transportation, i.e. Flanders. And Flanders is a big one for the simple fact is their shifts of work don't run in coordination, you know, with the normal bus line. Mm-hmm. So even if the bus was going out there, you know, I believe one of the first shifts in Flanders start at 4 or 5 a.m.
Right.
And the bus service doesn't start until like 6 or 7. So that there in itself is a problem. You know, but not only Flanders, you have to look at all the major employers, I think, within Columbia County. You start looking at Ginsburg's and right. Flanders and the college.
And the hospital.
And the hospital. And figure out how do you coordinate a service around all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, with Mike Tucker, and I'm not sure how much longer we're going to have him at CEDC, with he and Tony Jones and also Kim Flood, and I know Supervisor Sterling and a couple of other supervisors have been pretty passionate about it, and they're encouraged the fact that they can get it done. So,
I mean, it may be that it has to be some sort of like on call van service. Maybe, you know, it's like maybe we have to look at different solutions. Maybe it doesn't make sense to have a bus that can hold 30 people.
Right.
Maybe it should be a van. Maybe it should be a car.
I think that conclusion has been made. Is maybe we don't need the big bus types where you can have more. The commuter van.
I mean, we're not going to have 50 people that are right. going one place at one time. It's not, you know.
Right.
Of course, Uber would help settle this.
Well, so Uber would help if it was cost effective, because you have to look at.
Right. It's still not cheap.
If you're working at Flanders, and we got into this discussion with several other people about affordable housing. Mm-hmm. If you're working at Flanders, $8.50, $9 an hour, you're not.
Right,
you're not going to call Uber,
right?
Uh-huh.
So,
well,
yeah.
You may. I mean, it's close, so it's not like it's not far, so it wouldn't necessarily be a terribly expensive ride. But I hear
anything over $5 is
yeah, on a daily basis, right. It becomes expensive. Absolutely.
So, you mentioned affordable housing, and I know yep. that's one of your passions, and of course, it's a terrible need. Both, you know, in Hudson, in the county itself. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm assuming in Greene County. I mean, I know for a fact in Greene County, oh, it's mm-hmm. less expensive, but it's not necessarily affordable for some people. Are you looking at anything in particular? Do you see a long-term solution for, say, Bliss Tower? I know that you worked a lot on that during the Hope 6 yep. application. Hope 6 was a grant that mm-hmm. took high-rise public housing projects and replaced them with low-scale like townhouses and that kind of thing.
Yep.
What are your thoughts about affordable housing going forward?
So I think Hudson needs to take a total reval of its affordable housing, and the term affordable, when we throw that term out, people don't understand. I've been having conversations with several supervisors and aldermen about this, so I think maybe we first need to reclassify the term and call it something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, housing's level 1, 2, 3, and 4 is something I've heard, or some other, because it gets convoluted, and we start to get caught up in the fact that we're doing all this subsidized housing.
Right.
I don't think
we're not necessarily talking about subsidized housing.
We're not necessarily talking about subsidized housing.
But housing that an average worker in the area can yep. afford to live in. That's what,
right. Right. And that's when we start talking about
not looking
in the general term affordable housing.
Right.
So, in looking at that, again, I fall back on employers like a Flanders or, you know, like some of these
other employers. Because these are low-wage jobs,
right,
unfortunately.
Like the Walmart or some of these places where they're paying 8, 9, 10, you know, or even $11 an hour. And you may have the mother and father both working there, which has often happened in the Bangladesh family,
right,
and a lot of the black families. So between the two, for a family of four, they may have two kids. For a family of four, they're making $25,000-$26,000 a year. You know, and we're now to the point where we're calling affordable housing in the city of Hudson $900 a month,
uh-huh,
with no utilities included.
Right.
So if you're paying $900 a month, you now have to pay transportation back and forth. You have to pay for food and all the, you know, other things that go into it. We have a great deal of underemployed people in this county, and a lot of those people are relying upon social services to fill in the gap.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, either there's one or two things have to happen, or maybe both. And I know the governor is working on this, is we increase the minimum wage,
mm-hmm,
so that it makes, you know, being able to live in a community more, you know, available or possible, and or help do something to where we can lower the price point or the rent point for apartments. I think we need to do a combination of both, and how that gets done and how what that looks like. I put a committee together. Let's take a look at, take an evaluation. We did a housing study through ACDPA, and we spent a great deal of money on that. Let's pull that out, blow the dust off it.
Right.
Let's look at some
ACDPA,
which is Hudson Community Development and Planning Agency. They're pretty much
it's
in
the nonprofit housing side of it's like the HDC, the Hudson Development Corporation, is the Economic Development Agency, and the HCDPA is the housing agency.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's blow the dust off of that plan.
It was in depth. I mean, it's a good plan.
I think, again, have some one-on-one conversations with Bliss Towers, Crosswinds, Skylar Court, The Terrace, and people don't, you know, they look at all these different models, and they are very different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the difference between Bliss Towers and Crosswinds is a huge difference, right? One is majorly subsidized, and the other one doesn't get few subsidies at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's workforce affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we have to look at is, you know, the credit checks to get into some of these places. I mean, you have someone who's being released from a correctional facility, and a lot of times what a lot of people don't know, if you're arrested in Columbia County, and when you get released from a correction, a state corrections, if you don't have a known address at the time, they release you into the county in which you were arrested. So a lot of times these people are released to DSS. And where is DSS going to put you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
Motel?
They can't, even if they had the money to put you in, say, a Crosswinds, you're not going to get into the Crosswinds just simply on the background checking or the credit check in itself.
Right.
We're
going to have to leave it there. We've been, and I should have said this some time ago, we've been with Supervisor William Hughes Jr., who is the supervisor from the city of Hudson's 4th Ward and is also minority leader of the Board of Supervisors for Columbia County. Thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. It was
Thank
a great conversation.
Yeah.
We hope to have Matt Morrell, who's the chairman of the Board of Supervisors, on very shortly. We'll be announcing that, as we know. And
he's the supervisor of Stockport,
he's
the
Stockport,
right?
Yeah, Stockport.
Yep.
And I'd be welcome to come back with Matt if he...
Sure,
you know,
we'd love to have you.
Yeah, that would be good.
This has been At Issue. I'm Victor Mandolia.
I'm Debbie Mayer.
We'll be back.
Supervisor William Hughes.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks. This is At Issue on WGXE 90.7 FM, ACRA, Catskill, Hudson, New York.